Please take your Bible and turn it to the book of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 14. George B. McClellan was general of the Army of the Potomac during most of the first 2 years of the Civil War. He was a well-trained soldier, had graduated, I believe, second in his class at West Point Military Academy. He trained his men extremely well in preparation for battles that he was doing all in his power to avoid fighting. It seems as if the Army of the Potomac spent most of its time in formation and in parades and so on and not on the battlefield. His hesitancy, even his refusal and insubordination in dealing with President Lincoln probably prolonged the Civil War by 2 and perhaps even 3 years. Abraham Lincoln went through then, after he fired McClellan, went through a series of generals who just would not fight. It seemed that there was this grave apprehension of going into the battlefield. And finally he settled on Ulysses S. Grant along with Sherman, and Lincoln found a man that would indeed fight, and therefore he won the war. Saul is king of Israel. He has the promises of God, but he refuses to fight an oppressive enemy. Saul had been an experienced warrior. He had been on the field of battle. He had won many battles and will win many more. But right now, he refuses to fight. Where is the hero of the hour? God will use one who trusts in him. Please look in verse 1 of our text, 1 Samuel chapter 14. Now it came to pass upon a day, and by the way, this is in close succession to what we had looked at last week, where we have Jonathan killing, attacking either a garrison or possibly killing the military governor of Syria, or of the Philistines rather. And there's a great retreat of the Israelites. And so the Philistines, instead of going to the field of battle, just come in and begin to plunder the land in three companies. Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over to the Philistine garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. Now who is Jonathan? Jonathan is the oldest son of Saul. Remember, some years have gone by, and Saul, or Jonathan, is almost certainly in his 20s at this time, perhaps even older. He is the crown prince. Now, Saul has a number of sons, but as the oldest son, he is the crown prince, and under normal circumstances would be Saul's successor as king. We also know from chapter 13 and verse 2 that he was head of one-third of the fighting men of Israel. And as we read through the books of First Samuel, it becomes evident that Jonathan was a far better man than his father. And in large degree, I believe this was because he trusted the Lord, not just in battle, but also with his own future. Now, of course, we're trusting the Lord for our eternal salvation. But here we have Jonathan dealing with trusting the Lord for his immediate future. Here you have a man who is crown prince, and we will find out later on that here is also a fella who is willing to lay aside his potential to wear the crown of Israel because he knows that it is what God has ordained. A man of great character. And here's his plan. Now, we saw in verse 1 that he's planning on going over to the Philistine garrison, and he says he told not his father. Here's the setting. In verse 4, it says, and between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines, there was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other. The name of the one was Bozes, and the other one was Sina. And a fellow that I read dealing with this said that these could be translated slippery and thorny. What you've got is a ravine, which is very common in that part of the world. You have a ravine that, when they have the rains, would be full of water, but most of the time it's dry, and it's steep. And the other one side is all covered with thorn scrub, and the other one is loose rock and so on. They'd be very difficult to climb. Some years ago, I had gone up to Greenwater, up past Enumclaw and 410 to collect some flagstone from a cutaway where they had widened the road. And I'm climbing up this steep thing, and my son was with me, and I lost my footing, and I went sliding. I got all banged up and bruised. Oh, my word. I slid down about 20 feet because we just couldn't get a grip on this. Slippery and thorny. And a narrow place between two hills with the Philistine garrison evidently on the top of one of the hills. A height being a place where they could see, and also a very defensible place. And so he's going to go over there, and here's the condition he sets. Starting in verse 6, "And Jonathan said to the young men that bear his armor, come and let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For there is," and here's a key thing, here's the whole thing, "for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few." Now, how many people are with Jonathan? One. You've got two of them, and it's a young guy. He's probably a teenage fella who's lugging along some extra spears and swords and extra arrows and so on. Jonathan's armor bearer, and that's just, it's just the two of them. And he says, "The armor bearer said unto him, do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee, behold, I am with thee according to thy heart." So they're of the same mind. "Then said Jonathan, behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves to them." We're going to let them see us. Hey, we're over here. "But if they say unto us, tarry until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place, and we will not go up to them. But if they say, come up unto us, then we, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hand, this shall be the sign to us." Now, you tell me, you've got this steep, steep ravine. One side is slippery, and the other side is thorny. And they're going to be down there yelling, and the Philistines are going to come over and peek down. And the Philistines are going to say, "Hey, just a minute, we'll be right down." How likely is that? "Hey, come on up here." It's going to be one of the two. They're not going to ignore them. And so I think Jonathan stated it that way so that he would get the favorable response. Verse 11, "And both of them discovered themselves under the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, behold, the Hebrews come forth out of the holes which they have hid themselves." Remember, that is indeed what had taken place when the Philistine army came out because of what Jonathan had done probably just a day or two before, that the Israelites in fear had hid themselves in pits and caves and in thickets to avoid being found by the Philistines. "And the men of the garrison," verse 12, "answered Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, come up to us and we will show you a thing." That's the idea of, come on up here and we'll teach you a lesson. And Jonathan, now they're looking way up there. And Jonathan probably said to his armor, come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. Now, there's 20 men at the top of the hill. And Jonathan has got to get up there with his armor-bearer. And this is a steep, hard climb. But he's got confidence that this is indeed what God would have him to do. Verse 13, "And Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet." This isn't just walking. He's having to use all four to get up there. "And his armor bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer slew after him." He gets up there, crests the hill, and before the Philistines know what's happening, out comes the sword, and he lays into them, and he's just going through there, whacking these guys down, and the armor bearer's behind him, dispatching those that have been wounded as Jonathan goes through this garrison. "And that first slaughter, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, was about 20 men." These two guys took out 20 after climbing the hill. "It was about 20 men within, as it were, a half acre of land which a yoke of oxen might plow." In other words, how much it would be done in a day. "And there was a trembling in the host and in the field and among all the people. The garrison, the spoilers, they also trembled, and the earth quaked as if it were a great trembling." So there was a lot of noise going on. And the Philistines are thinking, hey, wait, what's going on? What's going on here? Now, who's responsible for this? Two men. With the help of God. And these fellows took out 20 men. there was a great, great success. Now, in the meantime, what is Saul doing? Saul is back in Gibeon, sitting under his pomegranate tree with his 600 men twiddling his thumbs. He does not want to go out into the field. Remember that the Israelites had a great deficiency in weapons. Who had swords? Jonathan and Saul. Did the rest of the men that were there gathered have swords? No. The Philistines were the oppressors, and they had made sure that the Israelites were not well armed. This is also the transition between the Iron Age and the Bronze Age to the Iron Age, and the Philistines had weapons of iron and were trained and so on as far as blacksmith and so on, but the Israelites did not have that, and if anybody was trained in that, the Philistines either took them out or brought them over to the Philistines and put them to work making stuff for the Philistines, but there was no smith in all of the land of the Israelites. I mentioned they had Joneses and Thompsons and so on, but there were no smiths. And so here they are with their pitchforks and their broom handles and who knows what else they've got, but no weapons of any consequence. And now the Philistines are fighting amongst themselves in their panic to get out of there. And this is all happening, go back to verse 1, but he told not his father. Saul is completely oblivious, but he hears an uproar. And he watches from his elevated position, his watchman, it says in verse 16, and the watchman of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away. And they went on beating down one another. Beating down one another. I remember several times when I was a youth pastor, we would be playing a game called Ghosts in the Graveyard. And we would be playing it in the woods, and you'd have a group of teens, and it's dark. It's real dark. And you're hiding behind a gigantic cottonwood tree. And there's a group of five or six. Doesn't have to be girls. It can be the guys, too. And they're looking around. They're like this. They stop. They're listening for the crack of a twig. And they're sneaking up through there, and then you wait until they're right there. And then you, jump out. Everybody's awake now. And I'll tell you what, they will knock each other down trying to get out of there. They are concerned about only themselves at that point in time. And that was the case with the Philistines. They are in such a hurry, in such a panic to get out of there, that they're knocking each other down and get out of my way, and I've got a sword in my hand, get out of my way, I'm getting out of here. And they're killing each other trying to get out of there. Because they heard the horror that had gone up on top of that hill with Jonathan and his armor bearer, but there's no binoculars or telescopes back in those days. So they're hearing it, and they perhaps hear the commotion, and they think, good grief, the Israelites, maybe they hired mercenaries or whatever, but we gotta get out of here. We're well into Israelite territory, and we're in a bad spot. And so in a panic, it says, I like how they phrase it here, they melted away and they went on beating down one another. So Saul, what's going on here? I didn't hire anybody. What is causing this? And then said Saul unto the people that were with him, number now and see who is gone from us. Now they only got 600 men. There's only 600 of them there. And when they had not, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Now what is happening? What is happening? Two people have totally, by the hand of God, have totally turned this whole situation around. End of verse 6 again. It may be the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by the many or by the few. Now remember, we are dealing with a rejected people at this point, as far as the leadership is concerned. Go back to verse 2. Here's the situation. This is what's happening with everybody else, with Saul and his 600, as opposed to the two men who are taking some action. Verse 2. And Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah, in other words, as far away from the scene of battle as he could get, under a pomegranate tree. He's lounging around there. which is in Migron, and the people that were with him, about 600 men. Now, what is Saul's status at this point? He's king, but we saw in the previous chapter what did Samuel tell him? He had usurped the position of priest. He had disobeyed the previous order of Samuel, and he has been told, as a result, because of his failure to obey, to follow through on what he knew, he was told that his dynasty would not continue. His dynasty would not continue. He is a rejected king. He is king, but he has been rejected due to his disobedience. So we have Saul there in Gibeah. And then verse 3, this is very interesting, because it goes into a long explanation to tell who this guy is, and I believe it's for a reason. And Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli. Now, if we were to go back to chapters 1 and 2, and we're not going to do that right now, but remember who Eli was. Eli was the high priest at Shiloh. Eli was a high priest descended not from Eleazar, but from Ithamar, the other line of the priests. A legitimate priest. But what was Eli's problem? Eli had two horribly wicked sons named Hophni and Phinehas, who, because they were the sons of the high priest, they themselves were priests, and they were fulfilling the responsibility of the priests, but they were greatly abusing their office. They were, and it says that the people of the land, as a result, abhorred the offering of the Lord. That they were committing fornication with the women that would come to the tabernacle, that they were stealing the offerings from the Lord. They did not. There was a process, and the offerings that were eaten by the people were supposed to be boiled. Now, me myself, you know, I don't. My wife's Irish, and she can eat boiled food, but cabbage and so on. But I prefer my meat roasted, and evidently so did Hophni and Phinehas. And they broke the law of God to get it. They would come and they would steal the offering and take the portions that they wanted, contrary to the law of Moses. And Eli did not restrain them. And as a result, God rejected the line of Eli. And yet, here you have the rejected king, and the priest that he has with him in the field is of that rejected line. Very interesting that this fella is the nephew of Ichabod. Now, of course, we're familiar with Ichabod Crane from the Headless Horseman and so on, but the word Ichabod means no glory. No glory. And so here we have these two people in the positions of leadership, and they are the ones leading the people there in Gibeon. And the people knew not that Jonathan had gone. Well, they discover that in verse 17. Now, was God talking to Saul any longer? We saw last week that Samuel showed up. Now, Samuel's job, we saw this at the end of chapter 10, Samuel's job was to give counsel to the king. Samuel had a special position in that he was a prophet of the Lord. That God gave him special direct revelation that he in turn would pass on to the people, and in particular in this case, to Saul. But because of Saul's disobedience, Samuel shows up last week, rebukes Saul, tells him his dynasty would not continue, and then leaves. Now, we've got a battle going on. There's a war going on, and you want divine battle plans, because if you have divine battle plans, you're guaranteed victory. David got this time and time again when he becomes king. But Saul has disobeyed. God's mouthpiece, Samuel, has walked away. There is no divine revelation coming. But Saul still wants to go through the motions. And so it says in verse 18, and Saul said unto Ahiah, bring hither the ark of God, for the ark of God was at that time with the children of Israel. I mentioned before that was there anything about the ark of the covenant that was going to guarantee the children of Israel victory in battle? What happened last time they tried this? It got captured by the Philistines. And we mentioned the fact that this is rabbit's foot theology, that I could have my lucky charm, I've got my rabbit's foot. I've got my lucky horseshoe. I've got my whatever it may be, and it's going to bring me good luck. I got to rub this thing, and I'll be good to go. And, of course, it's a bunch of nonsense. They are taking something that is good, something that represents God's presence, but they are totally misusing the whole point of the Ark itself. And so they have the Ark of the Covenant more, I believe, in the pretense of faithful service to the Lord than actuality. The Ark of the Covenant was with the children of Israel at that time. And it came to pass when Saul talked unto the priest that the noise that was in the host of the Philistines went on and increased. The noise is getting louder and louder. The yelling and the screaming is going on. And Saul said unto the priest, withdraw thine hand. Now, the point is that they were seeking, and it doesn't go into a lot of detail on this, but they were probably seeking the mind of God as far as what he would have them to do. Either with the Urim and the Thummim, which you read about sometimes, which are probably divinely ordained lots, or some other means, we're not exactly sure. But the point is that Saul says, forget it. Forget it. Don't bother. And in this particular case, I think Saul's probably right. I actually think he's probably right. If I'm standing in the middle of the road, I'm just standing there. Maybe I'm like my son. I'm standing in the middle of the road, fixated on a piece of roadkill. Wow, look at that. That is so cool. And I am so captivated by what is interesting me, what has interested me in the middle of the road, that I don't notice the truck that is coming. I, on the other hand, am standing on the shoulder of the road saying, get out of the road! And I see the truck coming. And I have one choice. I need to get him out of the road. Otherwise, there's going to be two pieces of roadkill out there. And so I need to run out there and grab him and extricate him from the situation that he has put himself in. The action is obvious. And that's what we have here with Saul. What he needs to do is obvious. He has been pushed by Jonathan's actions, by Jonathan's divinely blessed actions. He has been pushed into action. Now, if Jonathan had not done what he had done, where would Saul be? Under the pomegranate tree, enjoying the shade with his, you know, with his fellows around him, all, and just waiting for the Philistines to leave. But he has been forced into action. What he is supposed to do has now become obvious. Verse 20. And Saul and all the people that were with him assembled themselves, and they came to the battle, and behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was a great discomfiture. In other words, he gets his soldiers to go, let's go, fellas. Let's go. And they show up, and they see what's going on. Now, how many Israelites are involved in the battle before Saul shows up?
Two!
And as a matter of fact, they're probably still standing up there watching it. All they dealt with was the 20. They probably didn't have to do anything else. It's the Philistines that are making mayhem of themselves. And so they came down. It says, moreover, the Hebrews that were with the Philistines before them went up with them into the camp from around the country. Even they also turned to be with the Israelites, with Saul and Jonathan. So what you've got is, everybody likes a winner. Okay, right now, the Seattle Mariners are losers. Okay? But if we had a team that was in first place and maybe seven games out, I'll guarantee you that in spite of the economy, the games would be sold out. And you would see a lot more Mariner caps, and you would hear a lot more chatter about the Mariners, and people would be talking about it, and it would be the first thing you would hear at the top of the hour news, and it would just be, everybody would be all excited and talking about it because we're winners. But when you're not a winner, people don't attend the games, people don't wear the paraphernalia, and people don't talk about them, because after all, who wants to talk about a loser? All right, Israel's army was 600 men. Before then, remember, it had been a whole lot more. There had been thousands of people that had showed up. But it had dwindled down to that 600. What happened to those thousands who had showed up originally and then disappeared? One of two things happened. Either they were the people that were hiding in the rocks and in the holes in the ground or in the thickets and so on to hide from the Philistines, or they had deserted to the other side. They'd turned traitor. But now that the tables are turned, the fair-weather friends, the soldiers who had deserted, the soldiers who had been traitors before, now that the Israelites are winning, had switched sides. Hey, we're with you! You know, they want to get in on the action. And so all these people that had turned their back on Israel are now in the thick of the fight on Israel's side. And they followed hard after them in the battle. And verse 23, and so the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Bethaven. This is about 10 miles, 10 miles that they had gone so far in pursuing the fleeing Philistines. Now, if we were to end there, we would think, boy, this is a great thing. This is just phenomenal. Two guys, used of God, turned the tables and forced an idol king to do what he was supposed to be doing anyway. The book of Proverbs says, and I'll give you the gist of it, says that a little folly undoes a great deal of good. A little folly undoes a great deal of good. There have been, over the years, tremendous works of God. Look at church history. Just incredible things that God has done. And God and churches have gotten behind it, and organizations, and there have just been incredible movements of the Spirit of God. And then you have one or two charlatans that come in, and they undo a whole bunch of good. Or people that twist it and exalt themselves and take advantage of the situation. This, you read about the history of revival, and you read about some of the really bizarre and weird things that happened. And most of the bizarre and weird things happened at the tail end of the thing when the pretenders came in. That was the excesses of the pretenders rather than the actual work of God most of the time. And so we have the foolishness of the forsaken king. Now, they had pursued the Philistines from Gibeon to Bethaven, about 10 miles, hard hiking under any circumstances. This is rough terrain. Verse 24. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged of mine enemies. So none of the people tasted any food. We're going to fast today. And we got, until I'm avenged of my enemies, or until the sun sets, whichever comes first. Now, when he made that curse and forced those 600 men that were under him to abide by this, did he have any expectation that he'd actually have to follow through on? I mean, okay, he's trying to make an impression on his men that he really cares about this and he's a genuine warrior as he sits there underneath the pomegranate tree, by forcing all of his men to fast. And this statement was obviously made in the morning, because this whole battle takes place in one day. And if you look at the distances they're having to travel, this statement had to have been made in the morning for all this to take place. All right, we're going to fast today. I remember when I was, one of the stories I heard, it didn't happen the year I was there. One of the stories I heard, Brother Holmes, sure, all right, boys, we're going to fast today. Oh, I have fasted before, and don't recommend it. Don't recommend it. I fasted for 3 days one time, and I don't recommend it. Oh, such a headache. But he has this foolish vow. There, it is spoken without the expectation of actual vengeance. He's putting a burden on his men, and we find out later on that this severely limited the scope of the victory. Now, he said this not because of any benefit to be derived from it. One of the things we have to realize is that some people think that if I afflict myself in some way, if I punish myself in some way, that somehow this is going to bribe God to do something for me. That it, and that's the same idea of there's certain groups in Roman Catholicism that deliberately wear uncomfortable things. That will wear uncomfortable clothes. They actually put something around their thigh that pinches and stabs them in the thigh. And they sometimes and the Muslims do the same thing. Where you'll see this in Iran, where they have parades and the people will have a miniature cat of nine tails, and they're sitting there beating themselves on the back as they walk down the street, as if somehow this is pleasing to God. That if I beat myself silly, if I hurt myself physically, somehow this is going to get God's attention. Little kids try this same thing. They try to get the sympathy of their parents by hurting themselves. It doesn't work with God either. And yet, here Saul is, I believe, trying to bribe God and also impress his men by saying, we're not going to eat anything until I am avenged of mine enemies. And of course, it's all for show. It's all for show. It's all for himself. And yet it has been a great stumbling block. And it says, so none of the people tasted any food. Verse 25. And all they of the land came to the wood, and there was honey upon the ground. And when the people were coming to the wood, behold, the honey dropped. It was probably a hot day. And honeybees don't make an enclosed nest. If it's in a tree, you just see these big wedges of comb hanging up there. And on a real hot day, sometimes you'll have, you know, some melting and a piece break off or something. And no man dared put his hand to his mouth because the people feared the oath. But Jonathan wasn't there when Saul said this. Jonathan heard not when his father charged the people with the oath. And he put the end of his rod that it was in, dipped it in honey, put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes were enlightened. Yesterday, my wife and I had our morning coffee, and then we ran a few errands, and then Aaron had to meet somebody, at 1 o'clock, and so I dropped her off there to meet this deal with something there, and then she phoned me again at 2 to pick her up. And so I went and picked her up, and she was just feeling awful. She said, I just feel awful. I just feel sick. I just don't feel right. And she hadn't eaten anything that day, except all she'd had was her coffee. And granted, we'd been running errands and stuff like that, but we had not been chasing enemies over rough terrain for 10 miles. And I'll tell you, I got her home, and I said, what you need is some food. And so I got her some, believe it or not, hummus and crackers. And she's, oh, this is so good. And she within like 5-10 minutes, she was feeling so much better. And she looked so much better. That's the exact same thing here with Jonathan. Jonathan had been busy. He had exhausted himself physically. And he tastes a little bit of that honey. And all of a sudden, he feels just so much better. And then, after he's tasted the honey, then his men tell him about the curse that his father had made. And then said Jonathan, verse 29, my father hath troubled the land. See, I pray you, how mine eyes have been enlightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if haply the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found? In other words, they have a huge amount of food available to them, and they can't eat it. For had there not been now a much greater slaughter among the Philistines. And they're continuing the pursuit. Look at verse 31. And they smote the Philistines that day from Mishmash to Ajalon, and the people grew very faint. All right, they've already gone 10 miles. That gets them about to Mishmash. Then Mishmash to Ajalon, another 20 miles. One day on foot, fighting as you go. And they're fasting. And I'm going to hazard a guess and say this is either one of two things happened, and probably both. Either Saul was avenged of his enemies, or the sun had set, because it says in verse 32, and the people flew upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them to the ground, and the people did eat them with the blood. Now, in Leviticus chapter 17 and also Deuteronomy chapter 12, it states very clearly in the Mosaic Law, and this also, by the way, goes back before the Mosaic Law. This is also in Genesis chapter 9, which I personally believe, and this is restated also in the book of the Acts, that guess what? We as New Testament believers aren't supposed to eat blood. Now, I will also say that meat juice, when you're carving your roast beef, is not blood. My dad was a meat inspector and all that stuff, and it's not quite the same thing. But the point is that these folks were in such a hurry that they ate the animals without bleeding them, which was contrary to the law. They were so famished. And then they told Saul, saying, "The people sin against the Lord, and that they eat with the blood." And he said, "Ye have transgressed. Roll a great stone unto me this day." He had cast a stumbling block before the people, and putting them into a place of great temptation. And he should have made provision for the feeding of the people. And instead, you just have the people flying upon the spoil. And so he took control of the situation, and they did it right. Now, word comes to Saul that there is something amiss. And come to find out that Jonathan had broken the vow, the curse, that Saul had made. Verse 43. Then Saul said unto Jonathan, "Tell me what thou hast done." Now, who is the hero of the day, humanly speaking?
Jonathan.
By far. "Tell me what thou hast done." And Jonathan said, "I did taste a little honey with the end of my rod that is in my hand, and lo, I must die." And Saul answered, "God do so and more also, for thou shalt surely die, Jonathan." Now, this is a foolish vow. Now, thankfully, the people intervened. Now, remember that Saul has a tendency to blame the people for anything that he does wrong. And here we have the people intervening. And the people said unto Saul, "Shall Jonathan die, who hath wrought this great salvation in Israel? God forbid, as the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he hath wrought with God this day." Key thing there. It goes back to what we saw before. "He hath wrought with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan, that he died not. And by the way, something very interesting. One of the fellows that I read also said that typically when you have a curse that is unfulfilled or that you set aside, it comes back upon yourself. And so the curse turned upon Saul, which eventually it did. Now, folks, we don't live in a vacuum. Our lives influence others whether we like it or not. And very often we don't like it. We wish we could do as we please and not have to deal with any temporal consequences, but that is not the case. Our lives influence others whether we like it or not. And here's the question: are we a help or are we a hindrance? Sometimes God blesses in spite of ourselves, that we make a mess of it, and somehow God turns it into a blessing. But how much could have been done if we had not cast a stumbling block? How much more could have been done in this text that we looked at today if Saul had done what he was supposed to do, if he had not made that foolish vow that severely hindered the work? God's greater purpose often overrides our own foolishness. But too often we are stumbling blocks. We need to be careful. And Saul's overriding purpose was himself. He himself, his self-glory, his self-fixation, his concern about self is what got in the way. The Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. This battle, this whole victory here, by and large, the result of two men willing to step out by faith, empowered by God. Remember that you and God make a majority in any situation. And that very often, great works of God have been started by one person willing to step out by faith and do a great work because God is with them. May we be a help
and not a hindrance or a stumbling block.
Our Heavenly Father, give us boldness. Give us courage to do what is right. Father, may we get the focus off of ourselves and onto the greater work that you have called us to do. Father, it is so easy to constantly be thinking, woe is me. And Father, we hinder the work that you've called us to do. We need to be looking at the Savior. We need to be looking at the need that is before us and get our eyes off of ourselves. Father, granted, we have problems and we have issues and we have things that need to be dealt with. But Father, they are so small in comparison to the greater thing that lies before us. Father, may our priorities be in order. Give us a holy boldness to speak the truth, to step out by faith and do the work that needs to be done. May we be a help and not a hindrance. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.